We're talking about speech on college campuses and First Amendment rights. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A federal judge ruled Friday that Northeast Wisconsin Technical College violated a student's First Amendment rights after she was told to stop handing out Valentines with Bible verses on campus last year. So we're exploring this case against this backdrop of lawmakers across the country passing bills that aim to protect free speech. At least 8 states now have enacted free speech laws this year, Texas, Alabama to the most recent. So what's your opinion on free speech zones, these designated areas for public discourse? How should campuses moderate speech? Do you think we're more sensitive than we used to be? What examples do you have? 800-642-1234 is where we're at. Howard Schwaber is a political science professor at UW-Madison. He's written several books, including one on the First Amendment. Howard, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Well, glad to be here.
Well, take us to the situation at Northeast Wisconsin Technical College in Green Bay, where we're looking at First Amendment rights around Valentine cards. Help us understand what happened here.
Well, I don't have detailed knowledge of what the university was thinking. It seems like a kind of an open and shut case, honestly. Private individuals are free to express themselves as they like, unless there's a regulation, a neutral regulation about time, place, and manner in place. So what apparently happened here is that a university authority of some kind took it upon themselves to decide that one kind of speech was okay and another kind was not, and that's simply never acceptable. The name for that particular action by a government agency is viewpoint discrimination, and the First Amendment almost essentially never permits the government to discriminate on the basis of viewpoint. So you could have a rule that says no one can hand out anything to anybody in a certain area, but you certainly could not have a rule that says private individuals cannot hand out materials that have religious themes.
Well, do you think that there was this mistake, perhaps, in thinking because there was this religious overtone, this was religious messaging, and that was complicating the situation?
Oh, I'm sure that's right, and it speaks to the fact that in many instances, college administrators and college security officials don't have a good understanding of First Amendment principles. So what I suspect was going on is that someone at the college said, oh my gosh, if we allow a student to hand out materials with religious messages, we will be participants in promoting a religious message, and that might violate the Establishment Clause. Now, that's completely wrong. Where a private speaker is voluntarily engaging expression, you know, the Establishment Clause is simply not in play. But it is possible that some of the universities simply didn't understand that. And as I said before, that speaks to the need to improve public understanding of what the First Amendment does and does not require.
Well, the president of the college has said that part of the issue was the location of the students' actions. What are we seeing with location and free speech on campuses?
Right, so that raises a different set of issues. And it's important to point out, as the president's comment suggests, each case depends on a complicated series of facts. I should not jump to assuming I know what was going on, what the right answer is, without a very detailed knowledge of what the particular facts were. So the issue of location is complicated. In the first place, under the First Amendment, we recognize different kinds of locations. The term is forums. So in a public area, like a park or a sidewalk, the government has the least authority to regulate speech. The more an area is not public, say the inside of a classroom or the inside of a professor's office, the more we're of an area that is not a traditional public area where people gather and express themselves, the more authority the government has. And so what some colleges and political campaigns and cities have done is try to designate free speech zones. They've said, okay, only this area is covered by the free speech guarantees, and the rest of these areas are not. We're going to declare them non-public areas. These are very, very troubling moves. They haven't really been thoroughly tested in the courts. The Supreme Court has never issued a clear ruling about when or whether this idea of free speech zones is acceptable. Certainly on a college campus, to try and declare that some public areas are free speech zones and some public areas are not, almost certainly violates the First Amendment, and at a bare minimum, violates the spirit and the idea of free exchange and free expression.
We're talking about protected speech and the climate for speech on college campuses. Howard Schwaber is a political science professor at UW-Madison, and he researches First Amendment rights. You can join in. Do you think it's good that we're less tolerant of offensive speech? In what ways do you see the First Amendment being challenged? Join in with your thoughts on speech on college campuses, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Howard, do you think colleges today are pushing the boundaries of free speech rights? What do you see out there?
In some instances, certainly. It's a really complicated issue, and it's made messier by an intrusion of partisan politics, which one side or the other tries to claim that the free speech mantle and accuse the other of being the one at fault, which is not helpful. So we have, for example, a series of issues surrounding Title IX. That's one set of issues, and harassment, hostile environments. We have a series of issues involving student actions to prevent speakers from being heard or prevent the university from entertaining certain kinds of visitors, and that's one set of issues. And then we have the issue of the actions of university administrators. Actually, there's a fourth category, which is the actions of alumni and legislators trying to force colleges not to allow free speech, often in the name of free speech bills. Some of these bills are, in fact, better described as speech-chilling bills. So it's very, very hard to give a simple description. I don't think it's the case that there's really vastly more suppression of speech now than there's been historically. Colleges have always been places where rambunctious young people try to express themselves in ways that authorities disapproved of, and colleges do not have a sterling record of allowing whatever kind of speech it is that they disapprove of to taking place. It's worth remembering that the radical movements that started in Berkeley in the 1960s were initially as much about demands for free speech rights as they were about opposition to the Vietnam War. Today we see organized efforts and unorganized efforts to try and prevent unwelcome voices from being heard, coming from both the right and the left. It's interesting that the organizations that track disinvited speakers, for example, the phenomenon of speakers who have been invited being told, no, don't come here, those organizations find that those disinvitations come more often from the political right than from the political left, even though we tend to assume colleges are largely more liberal than conservative. I mentioned that fact, though, just because it tends to surprise people and emphasizes the extent to which this issue does not map neatly onto partisan questions. We have conservative legislators, conservative alumni, passing laws to prevent anti-Israel speech, for example, or to defund programs of which people disapprove, or to deny tenure to scholars who are outspoken, or deny hiring to scholars who are outspoken in one way or another. We have, on the opposite political end of the spectrum, students organizing to prevent certain speakers from being heard because they're viewed as insufficiently liberal or insufficiently progressive. And we have a relatively new phenomenon, which is the professional provocateur. People who are invited to campus for the sole purpose of trying to stir up as much trouble as possible.
How has that gone?
Well, not well for universities. The obvious example is Milo Yiannopoulos, and his infamous visit to Berkeley cost Berkeley $500,000. That's a significant strain on a university's budget. You could, in theory, drive a university out of business by repeatedly pulling stunts like that. And it points to the fact that our traditional First Amendment categories aren't really well designed to deal with all the different ways people have found to weaponize free speech rights.
We're talking about First Amendment rights and protected speech on college campuses. Talking with UW-Madison political scientist Howard Schwaber. He's our guide. We're also looking at legislation and recent court challenges in Wisconsin and this ripple effect around the country on campuses. Do you think it's good that we're less tolerant of offensive speech? In what ways do you see the First Amendment being challenged? What do you think? Are we more sensitive today? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. We'll get back to this conversation in just a moment. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. We're checking in on free speech issues on college campuses. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for joining us. Republican lawmakers reintroduced a bill last month that would punish students who interfere with campus speeches and presentations with suspension and expulsion. And the state assembly passed a bill last session that would suspend UW system students twice accused of disrupting others' free speech. That died in the Senate, but UW Regents had adopted the sanctions as policy in 2017. Connor Mathias is vice president of the UW-Milwaukee Student Association.
You know, at this point, I just think it's an unnecessary overstep by the state legislature when we have great administrations, great dean of students offices on campus that are can deal with this by themselves.
So your thoughts here, should lawmakers put laws on the books setting disciplinary rules for speech on campuses? Is this overreach or in line with legislating? What's your opinion on free speech zones? Join in at 800-642-1234. UW-Madison political scientist Howard Schwaber stays with us. Howard, as we look at student protests of certain speakers, extreme speakers, what have campuses done by way of bringing equal time to speech?
Well, I mean, that question presupposes a notion that campuses ought to give equal time to all possible views, and that's simply not true. In fact, the whole idea of a college, in part, is to exclude ideas or exclude voices as well as to include them. In Wisconsin, we like the phrase sifting and winnowing. There's no point to sifting if you don't winnow. So, for example, there's no obligation for colleges to present a speaker who says the Earth is flat. There's no obligation for a biology department to entertain lecturers who want to say that evolution is wrongheaded and to preach creationism. Right? On any of the areas in which university departments are expected to have expertise, we demand of them that they act as gatekeepers and help define what is and is not a respectable argument. What happens when that same idea is extended to political positions? And that becomes a difficult issue. But it's important to note, no one has a right to speak at a college campus. There's no First Amendment right to be an invited speaker. And the principle of free exchange of ideas doesn't mean that the university has to provide a platform for all ideas or all voices. What it does mean is that the university can't suppress voices in traditional public forums. And if the university has a system for, let's say, inviting speakers, that system has to operate in a neutral way. So, for example, if the university allows student organizations to invite speakers onto campus, universities don't have to do that. But if they choose to do that, then those rules have to apply equally and neutrally for all student organizations. Mm. By contrast, if the university is inviting speakers, there's no obligation whatsoever. In fact, the university is encouraged to do the opposite of providing a platform for all voices, to choose the most distinguished, most exemplary voices and present what the university think are the very best answers and attitudes. And that means a Catholic university can invite only Catholic speakers. And it means that a university with a STEM focus may invite only STEM speakers. And it absolutely means that a university, which is a government university, a public university, may invite speakers with whose views the university agrees. But if you outsource that function to student organizations or to outside groups, then you have to be a neutral arbiter.
Let's bring in a call now. David is joining us from Gurnee, Illinois. Hi, David.
Hi, thank you. Yes, one comment real quick before my question. I think many students go to universities and colleges based on basketball and football, so maybe they ought to look at what their stance is on this freedom of speech stuff before they choose their colleges and universities. But I guess my general question is, it's called Bill of Rights, First Amendment, Second Amendment. It's not Bill of Choices or Bill of Options. I guess I'm just very confused why there seems to be so many lawsuits when, to me, it's very clear. Bill of Rights is pretty clear. I don't know why people are contesting it today.
David, thanks for the call. Why do we see so much litigation around speech? Or do we?
Well, we do see a fair amount of litigation. I think that has more to do with the fact that people have become more litigious and more likely to use litigation as a mechanism to achieve a goal that they want than it does with any change in attitudes about free speech. There's polling data about freedom of expression, and contrary to what some people have claimed, over time that polling data shows no significant change and consistently very, very high levels of support for free speech rights. The more educated, the more college-educated people are, the more they tend to support free speech rights. Students exiting college tend to have higher levels of support for free speech rights than they had coming in. So in all those ways, you know, the narrative that colleges are teaching students to not respect free speech rights is just wrong. I do have to take issue with one thing the caller said, which is the Bill of Rights is not at all clear. What free speech rights require is a very complicated question, to which there is no easy answer whatsoever. No one thinks, for example, that free speech rights means you can say whatever you want, whenever you want. No one thinks that the right of free speech means you can engage in blackmail or treason or fraud or theft of intellectual property, right? So we start from the very beginning by recognizing there are categories of bad speech that the government is allowed to regulate. Then we turn to speech that is not in one of those categories. We have very complicated rules that the courts have developed over time for how and when the government may engage in regulation. So I wish there were simple answers, but keep in mind the First Amendment gives us a guaranteed right of free speech that is literally a few words long. And that's just not enough detail to answer all the myriad issues that arise in the course of operating something like a university.
So when you talk about bad speech or offensive speech, has our sensitivity to offensive speech, has that increased in any way over decades?
No, it's decreased. Over the entire 20th century, initially, governments were empowered to ban any speech that people found offensive. And then slowly over time, the courts have pushed back on that and said, no, being offensive is not a good enough reason to ban speech. And that didn't really become clearly true until approximately the 1960s. It was the Warren Court that said, no, just because your town doesn't like dirty pictures or communist speech or atheists or whatever it is, that's not a legitimate reason to ban that speech. So actually, this idea that we have a right to engage in offending each other, that's the modern phenomenon. And today we're working out the boundaries of that right. I should point out, though, that when I talk about categories of bad speech, offensive is not one of those categories. That is, it is not the case that the government may regulate speech simply because it is offensive. It is the case that the government may regulate speech if it is threatening or disruptive or would interfere with the mission of an institution or is inappropriate to its setting. And those are the kinds of questions that raise serious issues and the kinds of issues that become lawsuits. I know people use offensive as shorthand
sure.
for all the rest of this, but it's sloppy because no one who is seriously involved in these issues thinks that it's legitimate to ban speech or an activity just on the grounds that, quote, it's offensive, end quote.
Talking with Howard Schwaber, political science professor at UW-Madison, looking at the First Amendment and free speech on college campuses. Howard, another Wisconsin college made news this week when a racial slur was written on the door of a student. The campus has condemned the remark and is investigating. Are we seeing a rise in hate speech on campus? How do we qualify hate speech?
We are seeing a rise in hate speech, although that is a difficult term to specifically quantify, as you say. But we're seeing a rise in specific kinds of incidents, most notably in distribution of materials and graffiti and public displays promoting white nationalism, overt racism, and various forms of fascism or neo-fascism. That is extreme right-wing promotion of hatred. The reasons we're seeing this are complicated. You know, we go back to the idea of the march in Charlottesville, the University of Virginia. It is unthinkable in an earlier era that people would overtly identify themselves as Nazis and march through a campus, except that it's not, right? Because there was the march in Skokie back in the 1970s. So we are seeing a rise in incidents on campus, but what happens on campus reflects the larger society. And the incidence of hate speech, the incidence of racial and ethnic tensions, the degree to which being bigoted in public is considered socially respectable, that varies over time. And in periods where the larger society sees a rise in that kind of expression, campuses will also see a rise in that kind of expression. Let me say that the act of writing a racial slur on someone's door is clearly not First Amendment protected. There's sort of multiple reasons. One is that door is their property, so it's trespass. A second is, it seems to me, unquestionable that's a threat. It's very hard to imagine how you could interpret that as anything other than a statement, you're not welcome here, and if you stay, more bad things will happen to you. And in fact, there's a U.S. Supreme Court case that says, for example, a burning cross is always a threat, and therefore is never a protected speech. It's a case called Virginia versus Black. So in the same way that, you know, we can say that college administrators are sometimes pushing the boundaries of restricting speech, there's no question that students and outsiders coming into college campuses are absolutely pushing the boundaries of permitted speech.
So as we wrap up here, what are you keeping an eye on as you study free speech, as you watch campuses around the country and the courts?
Well, there are two things I'm really watching. One is it's long past time for the courts, and the Supreme Court in particular, to give some clear answers of how free speech principles apply on college campuses. There have been a number of cases, historically, as you'd imagine, having to do with those issues, but there have never been clear answers. And college campuses are uniquely complex and difficult contexts for free speech issues. So that's one thing I'm looking for. The most disturbing trend that I'm seeing in the last couple of years is the rise of legislation that I consider to be problematic from a free speech perspective. And the student whom you quoted raised the point. These so-called free speech laws often are written with good intentions, perhaps, in a way that they're most likely to chill genuine protest. If you can be suspended merely for being accused of engaging in disruption, or if you can be suspended because you've engaged in disruption, that's going to make you be very careful about whether you engage in free speech, because disruption is a very difficult term to define.
Howard, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Howard Schwaber is a political science professor at UW-Madison, written several books, including one on the First Amendment. Coming up, we look at millennials and trends in migration. Stay with us. News Update is next here on the Ideas Network. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and we're talking about how our state has seen a large drop in net migration of families with children. We're looking at efforts to draw in millennials as we watch our population age, as we watch the birth rate fall. And the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation launched a new recruitment campaign. They have these testimonials from young professionals around the state who say, in their own words, why they love to call Wisconsin home. And here's one ad of a family watching a movie in their spacious backyard.
With a booming economy and housing dollars that go further, you can find your dream job and that big backyard you've always dreamed of. Wisconsin, it's more you.
What do you think Wisconsin should do to attract younger workers? Are there certain policies or marketing strategies that you think could influence demographic shifts? We're at 800-642-1234. Dale Knapp is a public policy analyst. He's director of Forward Analytics. That's a research arm of the Wisconsin Counties Association. Dale, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
So in that marketing campaign, the testimonials are compelling. We were listening to them yesterday. They make a really solid case for loving Wisconsin, and these young professionals are doing really amazing things in these videos. But what does the hard data demographic trends tell us?
Well, I mean, historically, you know, when we look at who's coming here and who's leaving, we've been very strong at attracting young families, and which is not surprising. We have great public schools, low crime. We have all of the amenities that young families want. We've not been very good at keeping recent college graduates. The research that I've been working on of late is troubling in that it shows that we're not doing well with young families anymore. Since about 2010, that trend has sort of reversed. And that's a problem for the state. I think that's one of the reasons we're at 3% unemployment, is we're not attracting those young workers to the state anymore. And, you know, that's not only causing an immediate problem, it's causing a long-term problem, because they're not bringing their kids with them, which is the workforce, part of the workforce, you know, 15, 20 years from now.
Do we know the why there?
With migration, unfortunately, we don't know a lot of whys. You know, we sort of have to infer. We don't survey people that move in and out. We have the data. We don't know why. We sort of infer things. Like, as I was mentioning, it kind of makes sense about attracting young families. We know we've got great public schools. We know we've got relatively low crime. We've got those things. When a trend like that reverses, you have to ask yourself why, and we don't really know why.
You can only kind of shine a flashlight in certain areas and make some inferences.
Yeah, and we're digging in on that and trying to figure that out, but it's sort of a new trend, and so it's going to be a bit till we kind of figure that out.
So millennials are people who are born between 81 and 1997. Why are they such an important group of people?
Well, I think there's kind of two things. One, first, we have to not only focus on millennials, but we also, I'm a big advocate of long-term thinking. And so we not only have to focus on that generation, but also the generation after them, Generation Z. But they're important because the baby boom, the population, the generation that I'm from, is retiring or is nearing retirement. That was a very, very large generation. It drove the economy for 30 years. We're retiring. We need that younger generation behind us to fill the workforce. And so we're looking at the millennials right now, the generation after that as well. We need to be able to retain and attract that generation if we want to grow our workforce here.
So when we think about Gen Z, and these are really, really young people, I mean, what are we thinking of in terms of bringing them up here and keeping them here? What should we be looking at with such a young generation?
Well, remember, Generation Z is actually, the oldest of them are in high school now. So, you know, that's where, you know, they're going to be heading off to college. So we want to be able to, you know, we want to be able to retain them here for that. So, you know, each generation, as it works its way through, you know, has different preferences to some degree, I would say. And so everybody focuses on, for example, the millennials, how different they are. And they are different in many ways. But one of the things that we're seeing is the older millennials who, you know, we thought, oh, they want to live in big cities. They want, you know, all of these amenities. As they begin to form families and start raising kids, they're acting a little bit more like their parents than we kind of thought they would. They are beginning to move out to the suburbs. They're moving to smaller towns as well. So, you know, they don't admit it, but they are a little bit more like their parents. But
you would never admit that.
No, I wouldn't have admitted it either when I was that age. You know, they want to be connected. You know, when they're younger, in their teens and 20s, you know, they want public transportation. They want to be where the action is, I guess, to some degree.
Talking with Dale Knapp, who is director of the research arm of the Wisconsin Counties Association, what questions do you have about our state's shifting demographics and what it means for our economic future? Are you a boomer or a Gen Xer or a millennial? Gen Z, before school, what do you think policymakers should be doing to prepare for what's to come? How do you see age transforming your community right now? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Paul now, joining us from Heartland. Hi, Paul.
Hi there. I'm a 32-year-old. I don't know if you'd consider me an older millennial, but I just, you know, moved to the suburbs a couple of years ago. Grew up in the suburbs outside of Madison, so I guess I am kind of doing the same thing that my parents did. I just want to comment. I think a lot of what I see with my friends moving away or just, you know, staying away from Wisconsin has to do with policy. We're conservative. Our conservative policies over the last 8 years have, I think, harmed us in a big way when it comes to attracting young people. We're way behind on our marijuana policy. And I think just generally, you know, the policies that have been active and exclusive, and I think, you know, we need to be more inclusive of everybody.
Dale, you're a longtime policy analyst. What are your thoughts there?
Well, you know, public policy can have an impact. One of the research generally shows people move for economic reasons mostly. And then you sort of fill in behind that. And so, you know, one of the if we go to economic reasons, one of the challenges Wisconsin has, especially in terms of college graduates, is when you look at the pay scale in the state, we do a very good job. We're very competitive, top 15, top 10 states, and some at the lower end, at lower and middle end, I should say, the blue collar type jobs. When you get to white collar jobs, when you get to engineers, and when you get to computer science, we tend to be 10-15% behind the national average
on the pay scale.
On the pay scale, so that's one of that's probably our biggest challenge, you know, in terms of retaining college graduates and attracting them from other states. So I think that's really one of the big factors. We do have a great cost of living. Generally, our cost of living is very average here,
mm-hmm.
But recent college graduates don't look at cost of living as much as they probably should. As they get older, they begin to. But then again, like I said, I think the public policy issues sort of fill in kind of behind that.
Well, when you look at those white-collar jobs, you have to think about connectivity, and are you able to get your job done in the Midwest, or do you have to be on the coasts? How does that factor in?
Well, you know, when you look at, I mean, the millennials and you know, even Gen X, et cetera, they really want to be connected. And for most jobs, you have to be. For a lot of Wisconsin, that's not a problem. When you get to Madison, you get to Milwaukee, you get to the Fox Valley, that's really not a problem. The connectivity problem is really the number one issue in northern Wisconsin. When you get to the north, you lose a lot of that connectivity. And it's something we've been talking about for 15 years. And it's one of the reasons when you look at the older millennials, the ones that were in high school in the late 90s, northern Wisconsin over 15 years lost 40% of that population. The rural south, where, again, connectivity can be a little bit iffy, lost 25%. So that's a big challenge, especially when you get to those parts of the state.
Well, it's interesting that you can pinpoint some things there, because data is really showing you that there is a correlation there between broadband and your ability to do your work and your ability, you know, and to be cut off
from your
industry.
Yeah, and these stories actually go back to when I worked for the Taxpayers Alliance, go back to the early 2000s. You know, we'd talk to school district officials and businesses in northern Wisconsin, and even at that time, especially businesses would say they would generally they couldn't get a lot of things done connectivity wise between like 4 and 7 after school got
after
out,
when school,
sort of,
sure.
You know, it's because mm-hmm. the there wasn't a lot of broadband up
bandwidth
there. So so it's a challenge, and it continues to be a challenge up north.
Policy analyst Dale Knapp studies migration patterns, does this for decades. Wisconsin has seen a steep decline in net migration of families with children, and this is problematic as boomers retire. Meanwhile, Wisconsin economic developers have these ad campaigns to help attract millennials. So what demographic shifts have you seen where you live? Are local businesses thriving because of them or struggling to keep up? What do you think the state should be doing to help the economy transition after boomers retire? We're at 800-642-1234. You can tweet us, WPR Mornings. We'll get back to this in a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about demographic shifts and what they mean for our economic future. There's a concerted effort from economic developers and millions of dollars put into getting millennials to move here. The Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation launched a campaign recently called Think Make Happen. One testimonial is from Mike Miller, who owns a surf shop in Sheboygan.
Sheboygan's just a great spot. The geography of it on Lake Michigan. So we get some really clean surf. If you haven't been to one of the Great Lakes and you actually step to the shoreline and you look out, it looks more like an ocean.
Are you a Wisconsin business owner? What gaps are you seeing between your needs and the available workforce? Is your company offering incentives to attract workers? Join in 800-642-1234. Dale Knapp is a public policy analyst, and he heads up a research arm of the Wisconsin Counties Association. Let's go back to the phones now. Pam is joining us from Richland Center. Hi, Pam.
Oh, hey. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I was gonna especially emphasize the last comment about internet. My kids with satellite, my kids can't finish their homework if there's a storm. So internet is a huge thing. But the more important point, we have some great organizations trying to, you know, clear up the environment and make our small town, you know, attractive. What I sometimes see is, you know, like there's an emphasis on families, and I always wonder, you know, being a single person in a rural area is hard. And the other thing I really have issue with is the lack of diversity. We need to have more diversity and accept the people of color, the people of alternate lifestyles, the people of alternate religions. And so I'm trying to work with, you know, diversity conversations. But I think that if, you know, we can look at that sort of trend and see how we can attract for a variety of people, that would be a good emphasis.
Pam, thank you so much for the call. How do we make our communities more diverse as we look at these demographic trends?
It's a challenge, partly because, I mean, in terms of racially, for example, Wisconsin has never been very diverse. We're one of the whitest states in the country. And so we're gradually becoming more diverse, but that's something that sort of it needs a spark, I guess, to get going, because people like to be with people that are similar to themselves in a lot of ways. And so for minorities, when they look at Wisconsin, they look at it, it's very white, and they feel kind of out of place. And so as a state, as citizens, we have to be more welcoming and of a variety of people, and when that happens, then I think you start to change that. But it's a long process to do that.
Well, let's go to Tom now in Waukon, Iowa. Hi, Tom.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Political climate. I have a son that lives in Wisconsin, and he shakes his head. You've got the gerrymandering of the legislative representation. You had Scott Walker for years. This is not a political climate where people looking for diversity, as the last caller said, and kind of the dynamics that young people want to see more progressive. And your legislature is sitting, you know, basically on a lot of stuff. So that makes it hard to say, yeah, pull up stakes and move to that kind of a state.
Tom, thanks for that call and those observations. What impact does a political climate make on these trends?
Well, you know, as I said earlier, when we look at that the recent shift in terms of migration, it's hard to figure out why, what's going on. And so what you do is you look at, okay, so what's changed? I think Tom is right in terms of political climate, but I think I look at it a little bit differently. When you look at 2011, there was a lot of turmoil in Madison and throughout the state with Act 10, et cetera. And we were on the national radar, and we've been on the national radar since then. Now, there's political turmoil in all states. I think there's a different perception of Wisconsin now in terms of that political climate, that we've always been sort of Wisconsin nice and we've got along, even though politically, you know, there's been turmoil. There was turmoil during the Governor Doyle years, et cetera, but it sort of got accelerated and got on the national radar. And so if you're from another state, I think when you see that and you don't know everything else that's positive that's going on in the state, it kind of gives you pause. So I think that plays a role in sort of what's been happening.
Let's bring in Marcus now in Milwaukee to the conversation. Good morning, Marcus.
Good morning. So I'm a Gen Xer, and
I would say that this discussion has been had across many generations, probably from baby boomers on, where people move away. They want to go see what the life is, go to the coast, go to Chicago, go to bigger cities or whatever. But I think that if you look at it, like a lot of people in my generation, I've talked to my parents about this, they move back, you know, after they've gone and experienced some of that, because Wisconsin's a great place to raise a family. And I think that, you know, a lot of people just want to return home where their friends are, where their family is, and just be close to them. And so I think it's just, I don't want to say a revolving door, but it seems to me that people are constantly returning, even though they may leave for a while. I don't think it's necessarily a continuous drain.
Marcus, thanks for the call. It reminds me of one study once, and it has been probably not in recent years, but that looked at the distance a child lives from their mother. And it's found that as they age, it was closer and closer and closer. What do we know about family ties and when people move?
I do think Marcus is right in a lot of ways that we have sort of had this conversation. And, you know, people do come back to Wisconsin. When you look at census data, when you look at Wisconsin's population and the percentage of them that were born here, so they may have moved, may have come back, we're one of the highest states in the country. So, one, we don't, in terms of migration, we don't move a lot, really. But when we do, we tend to come home. But I think this conversation is more critical right now because of the baby boom retiring. Because if we don't bring some of those people back, not only are we not going to be able to grow our workforce, we're actually going to see a declining workforce, and that's going to have significant economic impacts in the state.
When you say a declining workforce, what might that look like here?
Well, you're going to, you know, you're employers aren't going to be able to expand. The ones that are growing that we want here, the growing ones, they're not going to be able to expand. They're going to look elsewhere to expand. And when they start looking elsewhere, ultimately, do they move their whole operation to that new place? You know, it would be good to some degrees for certain employees because there's going to be a worker shortage, which will tend to push up wages. So there's going to be a lot of dislocation, and it's something, you know, a shrinking workforce is really something we've never really dealt with. So it's going to be new and transition. But again, I think we can, the migration number, the most recent migration numbers show that in terms of total migration, we're turning the corner a little bit. We're seeing some net positive migration over the past couple of years. We don't know which age groups they're in yet, but so we're turning the corner. We need to turn it a lot faster, I think, though.
Can a marketing campaign make a difference?
It can make a difference. There's going to have to be a lot of things that go into this. But, you know, Iowa did this in the early 2000s, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know how much success they had. You know, Maine is doing something in terms of attracting working on attracting telecommuters. I believe Tulsa is doing something of the same thing. So everybody's having this challenge to some degree because everybody has this aging population. So we're competing with everybody else at the same time. So, you know, it's going to be part of a strategy.
Dale, thank you so much for joining us.
I'm glad to be here today.
Dale Knapp is a public policy analyst here in Wisconsin and the director of Forward Analytics, a research arm of the Wisconsin Counties Association. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.